All right, let's call this meeting of the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:32 p.m. on Tuesday, February 11th. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum present today. Our Vice Chair Coghill, Senator Kawasaki, and myself, Senator Rivak. And I'd like to recognize Senator Reinbold has joined us. Please turn off your cell phones. Today we have three items on the agenda. First is SB 166, Authority of Pretrial Services Officers. This bill is at the request of the governor. Second is SB 167, Aggravating Factor Corrections Officer. This bill is also at the request of the governor. And third is SB 162. Form of name on driver's license, ID, which is sponsored by Senator Costello. And my plan for all three bills is to hear them, take public testimony, and hold for further consideration. All right, we'll go ahead and begin with SB 166, an act amending the authority of pretrial service officers to file charges, make a warrantless arrest, or request the court to issue a warrant for arrest for escape in the third degree and providing for an effective date. I understand that Jennifer Winkleman, acting deputy commissioner of the Department of Corrections, will be presenting the bill. All right. Deputy Commissioner Winkleman, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and tell us about the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. For the record, my name is Jennifer Winkleman. I am the Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. Also here with me today is Kelly Howell, our Legislative Liaison and Special Assistant to the Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And I would also like to state that Casey Schroeder, with the Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, is also in the room should any questions come up, legal questions come up associated with the bill. I want to thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to introduce Senate Bill 166, as mentioned, an act that is amending the authority of pretrial service officers to file charges, make a warrantless arrest, or request the court issue a warrant for the arrest for escape in the third degree and providing for an effective date. So under current law, pretrial service officers may only arrest, file criminal charges, or request a warrant when a person violates their conditions of release under AS 1156-757, or when they fail to appear for a court hearing under 1156-730. So going back to HB 49, one now commits the crime of escape in the third degree if, while on this release, the person removes, tampers with, or disables the electronic monitoring equipment, or without prior authorization leaves one's residence or other place designated by a judicial officer as a condition of release. Because pretrial officers are unable to arrest, file charges, or request warrants for this offense, they must notify law enforcement or a prosecutor who must gather the information from the pretrial service officer in order to file the charge or request the warrant. Aside from violations of conditions of release and failure to appear, pretrial officers do not have arrest authority for Title 11 offenses. Pretrial service officers draw their arrest authority from Title 33. By amending Title 33, Senate Bill 166 grants pretrial service officers the authority to effect an arrest on an individual they are responsible for supervising. This will streamline criminal justice process in regard to these specific cases. We appreciate the opportunity to present Senate Bill 166 today and request your prompt and favorable action on this bill. And I will have Kelly Howell do the sectional analysis.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I'm the Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Corrections. Section 1 of the bill of Senate Bill 166 amends Alaska Statute 3307-030, Duties of Pretrial Services Officers. current subsection G establishes discretionary actions that may be taken by a pretrial services officer, including establishing circumstances when a pretrial services officer may make an arrest or request the court to issue a warrant. This amendment would add escape in the third degree under Alaska Statute 1156.320 as an offense that permits a pretrial services officer to file a complaint with the court seeking arrest or issuance of a warrant. Section 2 of the bill establishes an immediate effective date. And I would also like to note that there are 2-0 fiscal notes that are attached to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any questions for members of the committee? Senator Cockle?
Chairman, just the 1156.320, just tell us what that is. I think I heard you say it out loud, but so that we have on record the exact reference and its meaning. So 1156.320, which is the, I think is what you said was escape.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, it's escape in the third degree.
And nothing more, nothing less.
Correct.
Yes, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you just give a description of what escape in the third degree is as an act, if there's a more clear, just to clarify?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, one commits the crime of escape in the third degree if one removes themselves from official detention during any lawful movement or activity incident to confinement within a correctional facility or a misdemeanor, violates 1156.335 or 1156.340, and leaves or attempts to leave the state, while under official detention for a misdemeanor, removes, tampers with, or disables the electronic monitoring equipment, or without prior authorization, leaves one's residence or other place designated by the Commissioner of Corrections of the Commissioner of Health and Social Services for service by electronic monitoring. Or the critical piece for this particular bill is while on release under AS 1230, which while on pretrial service supervision, removes, tampers with, or disables the electronic monitoring equipment, or without prior authorization, leaves one's residence or other place designated by a judicial officer as a condition of release.
So, just to clarify.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under 1230, can you read that last citation, leaves the place?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, without prior authorization, leaves one's residence or other place designated by a judicial officer as a condition of release.
And so, Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify, so this, if a person were to be at like North Star Center in Fairbanks and they were to be on work release and just don't show back up, would that qualify?
Through the chair to Senator Kawasaki, this one is specifically for those that are placed on pretrial services as a condition of bail, essentially. And I can certainly ask Casey Schroeder to come up if we want more clarification for those, for what the escape is for halfway houses.
Mr. Chairman, just on that question.
Yes, Senator Cockrell.
So what have been the most common problems that brought this to light?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, when an individual cuts their strap or the device, the battery dies on the device and it's no longer activated, what is happening is currently the pretrial service officers are filing for a warrant or a charge if they have the defendant in front of them for violating conditions of release. And because that's what they have the arrest authority to do. Because HB 49 made escape in the third degree a felony for those particular electronic monitoring, tampering, disabling, what then happens is in the complaint, the pretrial service officer is essentially flagging sentences in there that state what the behavior was, so then the prosecutor will then screen for escape in the third degree. So this is essentially creating a streamline or an efficiency so that the pretrial service officer can just put the paperwork forward and the court system will review it at that point.
So, Mr. Chairman, there must be some assumptions in there, and because we're talking about a warrantless issue. So the streamline is they're already assumed to be under supervision, right? So that's why the warrantless issue makes it easier for them to just go get them under this. If this goes into law, it would be much easier because of the assumption of their conditions?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, not necessarily the warrantless part of it, because they're still going to be filing the complaint for the violating conditions of release. So they're still going to be remanding on the violating conditions of release. But because the threshold for escape in the third degree fits that and they don't have the authority to arrest on the escape in the third degree, the prosecutor then screens, or local law enforcement then screens it for escape in the third degree, and it sort of adds an additional step to bring it before the courts.
So, Mr. Chairman, if I might. So it's the upping of the penalty under 49 that brought us to the place where a warrant is required unless this changes.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, it was identifying that through 49, identifying that escape in the third degree, that this behavior while on electronic monitoring under pretrial release now fits the escape in the third degree.
Okay, that's all.
Thank you. I was just curious, Deputy Commissioner Winkleman, how often does this happen? I mean, how are the numbers? Where are they from? Are they from certain regions more than others? Do you have any of those numbers?
Through the chair to Senator Rivak, to the chair. I did do a quick poll with actually Juneau, Fairbanks, and Anchorage to find out what we were looking at and how many charges. And I will say that the numbers I got from Fairbanks and Juneau were actually 13. So a fairly low number. This is since 49 went into effect. And then Anchorage was approximately 23 cases. And a quick reference on the prior 6 months before HB 49 had gone in actually showed about 33 cases that would have fit the escape in the third degree requirement. So we actually saw a drop after 49 made escape in the third degree, the tampering with and disabling electronic monitoring equipment, at least in reference to the Anchorage cases that I took a quick look at for today's hearing.
Thank you. Any other questions from committee members? Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Winkleman. We do not have any invited testimony, so I think what we'll do now is open it up to public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? I don't see anybody online who wishes to testify. Seeing none, I'd like to thank you. And I think we'll close public testimony for today, but we'll have it open again when the bill is scheduled in the future. I'd like to note that for SB 166, there's a zero fiscal note attached. There's two fiscal notes, both reflecting zero attached. All right, next we'll hear SB 167, an act providing for aggravating factor at sentencing for contractors, volunteers, and employees of the Department of Corrections, and providing for an effective date. Again, I invite Ms. Winkleman to come forward to walk us through this bill. Sorry to have you play musical chairs there, but if you could please put yourself back on the record, I'd appreciate it.
Hey, good afternoon again, Mr. Chairman and members of the Senate State Affairs Committee. Again, for the record, my name is Jen Winkleman. I am the Acting Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And again, here with me today is Kelly Howell, Special Assistant to the Commissioner for the Department of Correction and our Legislative Liaison, who will provide a sectional analysis of the bill. And I will also note that Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law, is also in the room and available to answer any legal questions that are associated with this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today to introduce Senate Bill 167, an act providing for an aggravating factor at sentencing for contractors, volunteers, and employees of the Department of Corrections, and providing for an effective date. Promoting the safety and security of our correctional facilities is the utmost priority for the Department of Corrections. Senate Bill 167 establishes an aggravator at sentencing for persons convicted of promoting contraband in the first degree if, at the time of the offense, the person was under contract, a volunteer, or an employee of the Department of Corrections, and the offense was committed in the course of the person's contractual, volunteer, or employment duties. Contractors, volunteers, and employees of the Department of Corrections are granted special access within our facilities to assist them in the performance of their duties. This access bestows a high level of trust that is paramount to supporting and maintaining a safe and secure environment within our facilities. The safety and security of our correctional facilities is seriously compromised when contraband is brought inside the walls. When a contractor, a volunteer, or an employee of the department violates that trust by using their access to bring in contraband to our facilities, an enhanced penalty should apply. Promoting contraband in the first degree is a Class C felony that carries a sentence of 0 to 2 years. By adding an additional aggravator under AS 1255-155C, Senate Bill 167 would allow a court to impose a lengthier sentence on contractors, volunteers, or employees who are convicted of this offense. We appreciate the opportunity to present Senate Bill 167 today and request your prompt and favorable action on this bill. And again, I have Kelly Howell here who can provide a sexual analysis to the committee.
Thank you. Yes, please proceed, Ms. Howell.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Kelly Howell, Special Assistant and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Corrections. Section 1 of Senate Bill 167 adds a new paragraph to Alaska Statute 1255-155C relating to factors that shall be considered by the sentencing court if proven and that may allow imposition of a sentence above the statutory presumptive range. These are otherwise known as aggravating factors. The new factor would be conviction of an offense under Alaska Statute 1156-375, which is promoting contraband in the first degree. If the person at the time of the offense was an employee, volunteer, or under contract with the Department of Corrections. Section 2 establishes that the factor added under Section 1 applies to offenses committed on or after the effective date of the act. And Section 3 of the bill establishes an effective date of July 1st, 2020. There are 3-0 fiscal notes attached to this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Howell. Do we have questions from committee members?
Go ahead. Tee off.
All right, Senator Coghill.
Thank you for bringing the bill forward. First of all, how many times has somebody been charged under 1156-375, which is promoting contraband in the first degree?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I'm assuming that you're asking how many times somebody that would fit under a Department of Corrections employee.
That's fine. That would narrow it down probably.
Okay.
But we're kind of interested at a broad scale. What's going into our jails?
Sure.
And do we catch them? And do we charge them? And then if it is a corrections officer, I'd like to know that. So is it 500 people? Is it 20 people? And is it 2 in our correctional facility? So give me the scope.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, currently, and I'll kind of break it down into a couple different areas here. Currently, we are housing approximately 41 cases in custody statewide for promoting contraband. Most of those are attached to another case where they have likely been, they're incarcerated on another crime, and promoting contraband is an addition to it. I was able to check with our Human Resource Department on an approximate number in preparation for this hearing today, and it was less than 5 that have gone to prosecution. 5 cases since 2012 that have gone to prosecution that have been involved have been a contractor, a volunteer, or an employee. And that was just a quick glance at it, but it was an idea to be able to state that we're talking about a fairly small number.
So the difference between, Mr. Chairman, if I might, those charged and those convicted in that contractors, employees?
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I do not have that.
might be interesting for me to know that, Mr. Chairman, if you don't mind, mainly because I'd like to know if this aggravator has any impact, basically. And for example, let's just say, Mr. Chairman, we had 15 people charged, but only 5 people convicted. Why? I want to know why. And so that's kind of the scope. And then if an aggravator is a disincentive for those who have been convicted, maybe those who get charged then would, it would be a different level. I don't know the answer to that, but it would be a scope for us to consider. That's all, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. I would also be concerned with, or I'd like to know what kind of contraband were those 5 folks moving and how much. I assume that 5 people could probably move a whole lot of contraband over a period of time before they got caught. I think that's, I'm just curious in that. Did you have a question, Senator Kawasaki?
Not yet. Do you want me to ask a question?
Mr. Chairman, if I might
Senator
put
Coghill.
Some brackets around what you asked, the types of contraband there are in the first degree, there are 3 different types. What are the primary types that rise to the level of the highest volume?
So through the chair to Senator Coghill, a person commits the crime of promoting contraband in the first degree if the contraband is a deadly weapon or defensive weapon, an article that is intended by the defendant to be used as means of facilitating an escape, or a controlled substance.
And Mr. Chairman,
yes, Senator,
the ones that have been caught, charged, and prosecuted to a successful end are escape issues or dope, for example.
Through the chair to Senator Coghill, I'd have to get specifics and get back to you on that.
It'd be nice for us to know, Mr. Chairman, because first of all, we have heard, and it's mostly anecdotal, Mr. Chairman, that drugs find their way into our facilities way too much. And but it would, if let's just say it's primarily escape mechanisms and not the drugs, maybe we have a different problem. So it'd be nice to be know the scope of that.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. I agree. If you could get that to this committee, the information, some more specifics on the what and how many would be great.
I think it's a good idea.
Right. Any other questions? Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Thank you very much, Ms. Winkleman and Ms. Howell, for your testimony. We'll move on to public testimony. We'll open that. Public testimony is now open. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, is there anyone online that would like to testify? I don't see any at this point. I'd like to remind folks that they can submit any written testimony to our committee email at Sierra Tango Alpha, that's SSTA at akleg.gov, SSTA at akleg.gov. We're going to leave public testimony open for this bill, and we're going to hold it, and we'll have a hearing in the future. All right. For the record, there are 3-0 fiscal notes attached to this bill, which have been submitted. With that, we'll move on to SB 162, an act relating to names on state-issued identification. Mr. Tom Wright, Chief of Staff to Senator Mies Costello, welcome. Thank you for joining us. If you'd please put yourself on the record and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff to Senator Mia Costello, and she extends her apologies for not being here, but she's a little under the weather today, so she sent me in her stead. Senate Bill 162 directs the Division of Motor Vehicles to include numeric characters when issuing either an ID card or a state's driver's license, as long as the person's birth certificate states that it's, you know, a numeric character. And we have had one issue that I'm aware of where DMV said to either spell it out or use Roman numerals, but the parents of the child said no, they named that child middle name, you know, with numerals for a specific reason, and, you know, they've asked the state to honor the birth certificate, and the state says we can't do that due to federal regulations, you know, real ID, whatnot. This is introduced in response to a concern about state ID cards from the division for individuals whose names contain numerals, and that's the crux of the bill.
All right, thank you, Mr. Wright. Do we have questions from committee members? Senator Coghill.
So this is a state ID, but we still, if they're going to be compliant to the federal rules, they still are going to have to comply with the federal rules under the Federal ID Act?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I believe so, but I'm not all that familiar with real ID, you know, with the Real ID Act, the Federal Real ID Act. I do know that the Division of Motor Vehicles, I would imagine they're either here or online.
Yeah, I'll just let folks know we do have folks from the DMV online for questions.
And I guess, you know, the big thing is, you know, people sometimes name kids strange names, and, you know, in my era, I'm surprised there aren't more people whose name included seven, you know, for Mickey Mantle. I think it's something that, you know, it doesn't occur very often, but, you know, if that's what it's stated on the birth certificate, you know, somehow we need to honor that. And I do agree with the fiscal note. It's an indeterminate fiscal note. I did check with our IT people to see how complex it would be, you know, to change over a system like this, and I was told it's not an easy task, so I can't argue with the fiscal note that was issued.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Maybe if I could ask the DMV a question on this one. And who?
Yes, so we have Jenna Wamsgams, Deputy Director of DMV, and we have Joanne Olson, Interim Director of DMV. Mr. Wright, are they specific specialties, or just are they both online?
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe the I can forward to the question, and then either one of them can pick up. This deals with identification cards and licensing, and so the licensing might have requirements that are different than an identification card. So help me understand the identification card must display, and then the licensee's full name. But then we also have, towards the back here, identification document. And so there's a driver's license that may be different than the identification card. And maybe one of the folks at the DMV can help me understand, am I seeing that as two different things, or is it one and the same?
Either folks from the DMV, please put yourself on the record. I don't know. Maybe. How about Ms. Olson?
Through the chair, this is Joanne Olson, interim director with the Division of Motor Vehicles. The identification card and the driver's license are one in the same record.
So then, Mr. Chairman, if I might continue a line of questions with Joanne.
Yes, please, Senator Coghill.
Joanne, we probably can do this as a state, but what does that do on federal requirements? Do we bump up against them, or is this something that they will make allowance for?
I have someone else that should be on the phone that knows the Real ID really well. Will you hang on, please?
Sure. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, we will.
Nicole Pham. Hang on one second.
Mr. Chairman, I might be able to answer that somewhat, too. In your packets are two legal opinions. One, we did try to bump up against the real ID, but if you look at the opinion dated November 27th, 2019, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, please, Mr. Wright.
With regard to the name placed by the DMV on the face of the driver's license or ID card, the Department of Homeland Security is proposing to adopt the ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization 9303 standard. The ICAO 90303 standard requires Roman alphabet characters, allows a total of 39 characters on the face of the driver's license or ID card, and provides standards for truncation of longer names. Numeric characters should not be written in the name fields of the visual inspection zone. However, where the use of numeric characters is a legal naming convention in the issuing state, those should be represented in Roman numerals.
Hmm. Interesting.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Wright. Do either Ms. Wamsgans or Ms. Olson on the phone, do you have anything to add to this? I know you were trying to connect.
For the record, this is Jenna Wamsgans, and I'm the deputy director at the DMV. Through the chair, I do agree with that assessment on the Roman numerals that was just discussed. And more importantly, DMV also uses electronic verification systems when we are issuing identity credentials. These verification systems are such as the Social Security verification, also the U.S. passport verifications, and just like was discussed with the Roman numerals, these agencies don't put numeric characters in a person's name. So this could potentially cause verification issues that prohibit us from issuing the person an identity credential due to the inconsistent naming conventions.
Thank you, Deputy Director Wamsgans. Any questions from the committee members? Senator Coghill.
So if we pass a law as stated here, the default would be to Roman numeral characters, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Coghill, it already defaults to Roman numerals. Right. The parents of the child in question have been pretty adamant that, they named their child, the middle name was 10, right, for a specific reason, and I don't know what that reason is, but, it's on the birth certificate, and, at some point are we going to have a problem, with a birth certificate versus an ID that has the Roman numeral or, the letters spelled out versus the birth certificate. And, I guess we're just trying to accede to the parents' wishes on this one.
I would like to note that we've been joined by Nicole Tham, Driver Services Manager from DMVA. DMV. Senator Coghill?
Maybe DMV could answer this question, too. So I am a junior, but there are many people who go by the second, right? Mm-hmm. And that defaults to a Roman numeral as well. But if somebody put it as a 2, would we have the same problem? So it does pose that question. So I'm open to discussion on this, and I thought I had seen all the name extremities that you could see, but this is a new one to me. So, yeah. If we pass this bill as it is, DMV, can you comply with this?
Who wants to take that from DMV? Go ahead.
Through the chair, this is Jenna Wamsgans, the deputy director. If this bill was passed, there would be significant programming changes that would be required to change our customer management system to allow for these numeric characters in the naming fields. And like I mentioned, a bunch of our internal processes would break because we would be unable to electronically verify the name against different databases. In addition to that, there are other state agencies that rely on our data, such as the Department of Public Safety, Department of Elections, Permanent Fund Dividend, and to our knowledge, none of them have the ability to add numeric characters into the naming convention. So there's multiple layers where this would cause extreme burden the department, and there would be a very high level of programming changes that needed to be done our original estimation, which is why we put in an indeterminate fiscal note, was in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And to DMV's knowledge, only one customer has asked to include these numeric characters in their name, especially, let's say, within the last 2 years. So we don't believe that this low level of demand supports the extensive research, resources, and the funds that would be required to implement the proposed change.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One more question.
Yes, Senator Coghill.
Through the sponsor. Because this is kind of a one-of, is this on the passport, the United States passport, as requested by this bill?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coghill, would you repeat the question, please?
Does the passport have the numerics on? Does this individual have a passport, and is the numerics recorded on that passport?
Mr. Chairman, I don't believe a passport's been issued yet.
Okay. All right. Just trying to see how we can break through this thing. It sounds like this is an uphill battle, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. Any other comments or questions from members of the committee? None. All right. Seeing none. We're going to open up public testimony. Public testimony is now open for SB 162. Is there anyone in the room that would like to testify? Seeing none, we have no testifiers online. We're going to close public testimony. Public testimony is now closed for the record, and indeterminate fiscal note has been submitted for this bill. And we're going to set this bill aside for further consideration. I'd like to thank you all for your testimony and for attending the meeting today. The next meeting will be held on Thursday, February 13th at 3:30 p.m. This meeting is adjourned at 4:09 p.m.